what you are doing here on this radio station is so critical because it's the silence of the corporate media that allows the public to be disinformed here and remain ignorant.
...2012 Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein in town recently for Transforming Politics on the Prairie, Building the Green Party in the Midwest, a multi-state meeting and conference for Greens of the Prairie States, and an update to last week's story of proposed City Ordinance 140412 requiring food sharing permits and labeling for those feeding the homeless.
This is Jill Stein, and you are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody, June 19, 2014, www.tellsomebody.us. Follow me on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. Look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. The podcast of last week's show with Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly and with Richard Tripp and others protesting a proposed city ordinance on sharing food with the homeless has been posted. Look for links at www.tellsomebody.us. And we'll have an update on the food ordinance later in the show. The Greens of Kansas City and the Progressive Party of Missouri hosted a multi-state green organizing event billed as Transforming Politics on the Prairie, Building the Green Party in the Midwest. Jill Stein was the keynote speaker. Dr. Jill Stein is an American physician who specialized in internal medicine and was the nominee of the Green Party for President of the United States in the 2012 elections. Stein was a candidate for governor of Massachusetts in the 2002 and 2010 gubernatorial elections and is a resident of Lexington, Massachusetts. She is a graduate of Harvard College, 1973, and a Harvard Medical School, 1979. I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with Dr. Stein on Saturday. Give a listen. Jill Stein, welcome to Tell Somebody.
It's great to be here.
Tell me, how does a Harvard Med internist, I believe it was, mm-hmm. a medical doctor, mm-hmm. Become a political activist, Green Party presidential candidate. How did you move from one to the other?
Yeah, I mean, my story grows out of my really life as a mother. You know, it could be anybody's story. And I happen to also have been a medical doctor, a practicing medical doctor. So it has that twist to it. But I think anybody could go down this road and should go down this road. And our political lives are not different from our everyday lives. And my story was basically being a medical doctor and seeing lots of people, you know, really an epidemic of health problems in the clinic and in the community, from skyrocketing rates of asthma, diabetes, obesity, cancer, and looking around and saying, hey, I didn't grow up with this, you know, this is new. These were not problems of my generation. What's going on here is our genes don't change overnight. What's going on? And, you know, as I began to look into it as a physician, It was very clear that there were real drivers here from our diet, from our sedentary communities locked in by, you know, polluting automobile traffic, basically, to, you know, poverty and stress and violence in our communities and all that. You know, it's not rocket science what's driving this. We know what's driving really the epidemics out there. And I grew weary of giving people pills and pushing them back out to the things that are making us sick to start with. So I began to go upstream and to work with organizations like Physicians for Social Responsibility. And at the time I thought, well, gee, I'm a doctor. I'm doing, you know, I'm working with a great organization. We're doing good research. Surely our elected officials will understand why we should be closing down the incinerators, which are putting this toxic stuff, particularly into the food chain, mercury and PCBs and dioxins and things like that, that are related to many of these problems, and it could so readily be prevented while we create lots of jobs and, you know, create a recycling system or healthier products, etc. Or the same thing for coal plants. You know, we work to shut down coal plants and instead, you know, create jobs in clean renewable energy, et cetera. So I thought, surely there are policy solutions here which could solve these problems. And in so many words, it took me about 10 years to learn that the system is designed to be this way. And the money flows in to buy the policies that we've got. And being a good citizen and working through the system as it exists hasn't changed things. We're only moving in the wrong direction faster as money becomes concentrated further into the hands of the 1% and the 0.01%, actually. Greater and greater concentrations of wealth mean a more and more corrupt political system that continues to serve Wall Street, pharmaceutical companies, health insurers, fossil fuels, etc. We could have a completely different system that's working for us. So in my frustration as a mother and a medical doctor, I became an activist. One last thought about that. When people ask me what kind of medicine I'm practicing now, I say political medicine, because it's the mother of all illnesses, and we got to fix that illness if we're going to fix all the other things that literally are killing us.
I've got to wonder, is there any hope at all of saving this patient?
Absolutely. In fact, the patient knows what to do. And the patient, that is the public, everyday people, the 99%, support doing the things that we need to do, getting money out of politics, taxing the rich, providing affordable public higher education, which actually should be free, providing health care as a human right, downsizing the military and getting the U.S. out of the business of policing the planet, which is not really policing the planet. It's more like policing a market system that's good for multinational corporations, you know, supporting dictatorships that provide us with fossil fuels, you know. So the public knows what needs to be done. I had my moment of revelation came early on in this process for me. You know, we're all taught to think that we are marginal, that we're the fringe, that we're the lunatic fringe. That is, we activists, we who are working for the public good and the public interest, we're taught to think that, oh, we're, you know, we're really on the margins. We're absolutely not. And I learned that the first time I ran for office, which was running for governor in Massachusetts in 2002 against Mitt Romney, and I was in a debate, a televised debate, which we had fought very hard to get into. We finally got in. This first debate was televised. And in the course of the debate, which happened in a private TV studio, so it was just the candidates and the moderator and the cameraman, you know, and I was advocating for, you know, healthcare as a Medicare for all system, basically, for jobs as a right, at living wages as a right, for downsizing the military, clean energy, you know, the usual things that the Green Party talks about. And in the debate, you know, I was treated as the lunatic fringe, and those ideas weren't even rebutted because they were considered so marginal. And when the debate was over and we all walked out into the waiting press, I was mobbed by the press who told me I had won the debate. And I said, what do you mean I won the debate? And they said, well, you won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And it's like all of a sudden the curtain went up on the scam that we are subjected to every day that tells us we are, you know, marginal, that we have crazy ideas. In fact, this is the core of American values. This is where most people are. Why in Eric Cantor's race was he beat by a candidate who was running to his right? Although that somewhat oversimplifies what happened. But what was really critical in that race was that there was a 12% turnout. This was not the opinion of the American public. And, you know, I think that has an awful lot to do with what is described as the shifting demographic of our politics, or I should say the shifting political spectrum over the last, you know, couple of decades. We've been steadily marching to the right, not because the public has actually moved to the right, actually, but because, you know, A, money is more corrupting politics than ever, but that people are dropping out. People are not bothering to vote because the two major parties don't really offer options that will fix these problems and that bring everyday people into the political process.
Well, that Cantor example, I think, is an interesting one. And as you say, the turnout was so low, probably cautionary against reading too much into it, whatever you think. But apart from almost everybody saying that this is a huge Tea Party victory, John Nichols and others have pointed out that on Wall Street issues, this guy ran in a way that would appeal to a lot of Democrats and maybe Green Party people.
Exactly. Right. It could be as well described as running way to the left, way, way to the left of anything. I mean, and this is where the right and the left kind of come together. In my view, it shouldn't be seen as right or left, but rather a top-down political system or a bottom-up political system. And, you know, from the point of view of everyday people, we are being totally screwed by Wall Street and by big corporations. I've been astonished myself, because I've been to a few libertarian events recently, how much Greens and libertarians have in common now between, you know, opposing this pervasive, all over the place war on terror, which will never end, which is a war against anybody. You know, it's not a defined war, and the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, is so dangerous because it says that the government can declare whoever they want essentially a terrorist and throw you into, you know, prison and lock you up. So at any rate, Greens and libertarians really agree on defending and restoring our civil liberties, which have been trashed by the Obama administration, even worse than they were under the Bush administration. We agree on the war. We agree on legalizing recreational drugs, substances like like marijuana, which is arguably far less dangerous than alcohol and nicotine. But it turns out they, too, are now very anti-corporate, which seems new to me. You know, I didn't get that from them a couple of years ago, but now there's a really strong anti-corporate strain. They are anti-GMO. They are anti-fracking. I mean, it's really interesting how there's this kind of convergence outside of the moneyed politics of everyday people who are saying, let's not worry too much about the labels. Let's just get together and take our democracy back. And, you know, back to your question about, is there hope for the patient? Absolutely. In Alice Walker's words, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. That's the reality. We do have it. I mean, when we decide to do something about it, we get it done. Like, we decided to say no to Obama's expanding the disastrous war in the Middle East when he attempted to open up a new front in the bombing campaign against Syria. And people said no. And, you know, we were told resistance is futile. You know, we're going to do this. And everyday people said no, forced Obama to go to Congress. And then we forced him to back down from going to Congress because it was clear that Congress was feeling the heat and they weren't going to be able to support that. So we were able to do that. We have closed some 12 or so nuclear power plants in the last year that were either taken offline from being built and designed, or which were either shut down or put into a very near-term shutdown mode. We have defeated these so-called corporate trade agreements. They tend to pass because they're kept secret. The latest one, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is NAFTA on steroids. It would send even more jobs overseas, undermine bargaining power at home for workers, causing further decline in workers' wages and benefits and security and all that. And
apart from what WikiLeaks has leaked, it's all secret.
Exactly.
Even Congress can't read most of it.
And if they want to go read it, they cannot take in a pencil. They can't take notes. They can't bring in a staffer. It's outrageous, you know. Trade is supposed to be the province of Congress, you know, and yet, as opposed to the president, you know, who's been taking the lead and trying to push this through. It's absolutely outrageous. But what we have to remember here is that we have won these trade battles. There are some approximately 12 of these corporate trade agreements since, I believe, the WTO was established, or perhaps it was since NAFTA. I don't recall exactly, but we have won many of these battles when we've been able to make them public. And again, this is where what you are doing here on this radio station is so critical, because it's the silence of the corporate media that allows the public to be disinformed here and remain ignorant. It was no coincidence that our founding fathers, being advised by our founding mothers in many cases, that they wrote into our Bill of Rights as number one that we have a free press, because if we don't have a free press that is not held hostage by either government or by corporations and big money, we need that free press if we're going to have an informed electorate. Without an informed electorate, you can't really have a democracy. So the point there is that we have achieved many victories where we've been told resistance was futile. So I do think this patient can heal itself when we are, you know, basically when we are alerted to the fact that we can do it and how we can do it. And I want to just be sure and get in two websites. So one is Green Party, just gp.org, gp.org, which is the National Party's website. And I would also refer you to the website of a project that I'm very involved in right now called the Global Climate Convergence. And that's the name for it, globalclimateconvergence.org. And maybe we'll get to that if we have a little time. But it's basically using the climate crisis, which makes all of our other struggles far more difficult, because all these things are connected. As climate gets worse, we have more drought, the price of food goes up, you know, the economic struggles get far worse. You have terrible storms which hit low-income people and communities of color hardest. You know, so all these struggles are interrelated, but the climate struggle, we know now, is on a timer, and that timer goes off in the next couple of decades, if we even have that long. So the climate is sort of a crisis that says, hey, guys, you got to get it together. We have to work together. Working alone in our different silos, it's a game of divide and conquer. So globalclimateconvergence.org is one of the places where we're getting together in a really exciting way.
Okay, we'll repeat those websites after the interview and get them up at tellsomebody.us. Climate, very good arguments can be made, maybe indisputable, that that's the biggest thing. But I'm glad you brought up the founders and the free press. David Cobb was just here a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how facts matter in an objective sense, but in terms of convincing people, they don't matter so much as they should, because people want stories. And with failing journalism and media, we're getting the wrong stories. We're getting fairy tales of exceptionalism and so forth. You mentioned nuclear a couple of minutes ago, and last fall you were on Bill Moyers with another physician, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's been on this show a couple of times on the phone, talking about nuclear and both the issue of nuclear itself, but also the issue of media. I think in that interview with Moyers, you said something about Fukushima should be in the headlines a whole lot more than it is. And a story that's been PR'd by the nuclear industry is that this is a clean alternative that Obama's proud to have, and it's all of the above thing. Recently, I got into a food fight on Twitter with nuclear promoters, in effect saying if you don't support nuclear, you are promoting dirty coal and dirty gas and fossil fuels. And they could point to things like a Forbes article that said nuclear was the safest industry because nobody's died from Fukushima or Three Mile Island.
Or Chernobyl.
Just a couple in Chernobyl. So both the issue of a filthy power alternative itself and the issue of media. No specific question there, but just go with it.
Yeah, great, great. And that's a great example, I think, of how we are talked into a corner of hopelessness and helplessness. You know, the media, the corporate media, in all of its wisdom, gives us two horrible choices and says, pick your poison. You know, either die from, you know, from the coal plant pollution and the climate catastrophe that results from it, or die from, you know, nuclear power and the next Chernobyl or the next Fukushima, which could happen really at any nuclear power plant, which is essentially an atomic weapon waiting for detonation located in population centers. That's really what nuclear power plants are. And in the era of a warming climate, a nuclear power plant is something you do not want to have within 5,000 miles of where you are. Because the things that happen with climate change, like drought or floods, are absolute triggers for nuclear disasters. All you have to do to detonate a nuclear power plant is deprive it of a power source. And this can happen. Its own power can be shut down in the case of flood or drought or other serious problem. The nuclear power plant cannot generate its own cooling. If you lose the power grid, like because sea level rises or because you have flooding or whatever, or because there's a war, you know, going on in Iraq and suddenly, you know, fuel isn't moving, it's not coming in. There are just so many ways you can trigger a lethal event at a nuclear power plant. They need to be decommissioned as quickly as possible. But getting back to your larger point, you know, about how do we move forward on this issue when the media tells us there are only two lethal ways to solve this problem. You know, this is why we need to be organized. This is why we need to get together. This is why we need public media. But, you know, in terms of the solution itself, hello, we do have renewable energy. Hello, it is cost competitive. And hello, we can actually do without a whole lot of this energy. We don't need to be so energy intensive. It is not a loss of our magnificent high on the hog lifestyle. It's not as if high on the hog lifestyle, you know, having three homes and flying all around the world is a guarantee of happiness. You know, there's no linkage between that kind of wealth and happiness. So, you know, we don't have to live with the incredibly energy intensive way of life that we have. We can start our own community gardens and create a much healthier food supply, actually, for being local and fresh, at the same time that we greatly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce our energy requirement within our food system, within our public transportation system, by having energy-efficient public transportation options, which are every bit as satisfying and as convenient and all that as, you know, private and personal options, provided they're good and they're well-funded. They're terrific. You know, we do need community solutions to things. So they try to talk us into a corner of helplessness based on disinformation and wrong facts. Germany is providing, on good days, 70% of their electrical power now through renewables, through wind and solar. And they're at a far worse, you know, altitude for solar than most places, many places in the U.S., certainly than here in Missouri. So these are options that are open to us right now that we can move down. What we just have to do is get the fossil fuel companies out of the business and the nuclear power companies out of the business of running government. They're not just defining our you know, our energy policies. They're, you know, deciding who gets elected and then who gets appointed to our regulatory commissions and all that. You know, we need, David Cobb is absolutely right. You know, we need a free media. We need to get corporations out of the business of running government and reduce them to what they should be, which is financial entities. They are not people who have political rights and then as very powerful and wealthy people to essentially take over our political systems. That's a coup. You know, we've been cooed, we've been revolutioned, and we need to take our democracy back. Okay. And we can do that.
We'll be back with more with Dr. Jill Stein after you listen to this. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clammer, and you've been listening to a conversation I had on Saturday with 2012 Green Party presidential nominee, Dr. Jill Stein. Let's get right back to it.
Jumping to presidential politics for a minute, I guess in the mainstream there's nothing to talk about except Hillary, and we have to talk about her now, not wait a year or so. But you ran for president on the Green Party in 2012, and I don't know if you're running in 2016. You can let me know on that. But, you know, in my circles, among people who are probably all of them would describe themselves somewhere left to center, progressive, liberal, whatever, a lot of them, you bring up their name, Ralph Nader, they get very angry immediately. It's as if it was 100% his fault that Gore didn't get elected. Everything would have been fine if he had. And that if you criticize the Democrats or don't vote for an Obama or a Kerry, you're enabling a George W. Bush or whomever. Why get involved in presidential politics? Shouldn't the Green Party just start up with local and state things and build some sort of base first?
So let me first address the politics of fear, because that's basically what you've described as the opinion that we have to vote for the lesser evil. You know, we have to hold our noses and vote for someone who may not be so good, because if we voted for the candidate that really represents our values and the policies we support, then, you know, then we risk getting somebody who would be really terrible. Well, that's been practiced, certainly, I mean, actually a long time. That politics of fear has been around quite a while, but certainly since the Bush-Nader-Gore in 2000. A lot of people have been practicing that, and what has it brought us? You know, let's look at the record here. Because what that does, that politics of fear tells you to be silent. It tells you to be politically silent. Just hold your nose and go along to get along. What has that political silence brought us? You know, the evidence is that silence is not an effective political strategy. And where have we gone with that? Compare the Bush record to the Obama record on the wars. Became much more pervasive and expansive under Obama. The attack on our civil liberties.
Obama prosecuting whistleblowers.
Yeah.
Drone strike.
The use of the Espionage Act. More times under Obama than all other prior presidents put together. You know, going after Edward Snowden and Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning, for that matter. You know, it's absolutely outrageous how the press is being intimidated here. You know, you can go, the bailouts of Wall Street. Under Bush, it was like $700 billion in the TARP program. But then under Obama, it's been limitless trillions of dollars. And it's still going on. And it still hasn't been fixed. We're still providing some $65 billion a month to Wall Street and large corporations through this so-called quantitative easing policy run by the Fed. You know, so we're still giving Wall Street a free ride. Look at what's been inflicted on students. You know, the countless millions of students, over 40 million now, students and recent graduates who are in debt. And, you know, and look at the trade agreements. Because what Obama is pushing is NAFTA on steroids, which means losing more jobs overseas and undermining wages further at home, and the continued attack on unions. Obamacare, for example, you know, Obama trashed single payer. You know, it was like going to be the public option, and then, oops, well, you know, it's a total case of bait and switch.
Let's get real. We would like single payer, but the reality is, this is the best we can do. Let's not criticize it. We're playing into the hands of Republicans.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what they're saying, because most people support single payer. You know, if we actually had leadership that wasn't held hostage by the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, we could do it. I live in Massachusetts. We have a name for Obamacare. We call it Romneycare, because that's where it came from. So how exactly would Romney have been so much worse than Obama? That's what we got anyhow. You know, so this is nonsense. This is propaganda. Sometimes I call myself a political therapist. You know, we all have to be political therapists for each other and help our friends break up with abusive political relationships. Because the people who say, you know, I'm a Democrat, I'm sticking with it no matter what, you know, because it's going to be better than the Republicans, they need to just look at the record. They need to look at the facts, because the facts don't support that anymore. If you talk to young people, they're not in that place. This, you know, my party kind of, because it did great things 50 years ago, doesn't mean a whole lot to young people who are growing up without jobs, who are carrying around, you know, $40, $50, $60, $100,000 in debt, and who are working, you know, minimum wage jobs. You know, we need the politics of fear has delivered everything we were afraid of. All the reasons we were told not to stand up and vote our values, we've gotten those dreaded things by the droves, by operating under the politics of fear. It needs to be replaced with the politics of courage. About your other point, starting local, I totally agree. You know, that's where we're going to make breakthroughs and make progress, probably. But you never know. I mean, number one, you never know when dramatic things are going to happen and people are going to be ready to make a switch. That happens sometimes. You know, it just happened in an odd way in Virginia. It happens in, you know, it's happened. Look at Jesse Ventura's race, you know, in Minnesota. They had an open debate, and guess what? He went from like 3% to 30% in the course of a couple of debates. In my debate, you know, running for governor, I won the debate. You know, people had no idea who I was or anything else, but those policies that speak to people's needs change people's minds.
No wonder that corporate Democrats and Republicans don't want to let anybody else.
Exactly. After that debate where I was voted winner, I was taken out of the debate and not allowed back in. And yes, and we are, by the way, working on a campaign right now to see if we can't apply a whole lot of pressure to create more open debates, either to open up the commission or to have a really well promoted and highly visible alternative debate, like Amy Goodman hosted, and also United We Stand, Free and Equal hosted third-party debates last time, too. So it's not, you know, I don't think it's pointless or useless to be working at the top. If we don't work at that, put it this way, by participating in that dialogue and in that debate, whether it's televised or whether it's just happening through alternative media, we get the word out, we energize a lot of people at the local level, and we change local politics also by participating in national politics.
Jill Stein, thank you very much for your time. I'd like another couple hours. I'm not going to get it today.
It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein. The websites she mentioned were www.gp.org and www.globalclimateconvergence.org. As noted at the top of the show, last Thursday's show included coverage of protests against a proposed Kansas City Ordinance 140412 requiring food-sharing permits and labeling for feeding the homeless. The ordinance went to the full city council for a vote that afternoon. I'd encourage you to listen to last week's show online if you missed it. Links at tellsomebody.us. The city council meeting in question last Thursday started about an hour late, and then other business was dealt with before the food sharing ordinance came up. I've got just a couple of clips here from over an hour of discussion.
Law 40412, amending Chapter 30 Code of Ordinances by repealing Section 3073 permits and enacting in lieu thereof a new Section 73 of light title and subject matter to add food sharing permits to the City of Kansas City, Missouri for a food code for the purpose of protecting all recipients of food items, amending Section 30-701B by adding a new Section 701B45 to require compliance with all laws, directing the City Manager to coordinate training and educational workshops with the Homeless Service Coalition of Greater Kansas City and to facilitate connections between food sharing permittees and neighborhood associations in establishing an effective date. Neighborhood Committee recommends do pass, read nay.
After a good bit of discussion in support of the ordinance, mostly from Councilman Scott Wagner, Councilman Jermaine Reed moved to send the proposed ordinance back to committee.
Thank you, Councilwoman Quarles.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This ordinance creates a new food code permit initiative called food sharing, and the cost of the permit is $0, and this initiative would take effect in November of 2014, it passed. There was a lot of input from the community that we had yesterday.
Many of them are opposed to the ordinance that has been introduced. And so with that, again, I make a motion that we rescind this back to committee.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that the ordinance be sent back to committee. Discussion? Councilman Wagner.
Mr. Mayor, I think that idea will generate nothing new. The reality is, as it has happened over the last 3 weeks, we can tell you what the law is, we can tell you what a permit does, we can tell you that it's free. The reality is that, having said all that, that doesn't seem to matter. The reality is you can meet with organizations for a year and a half and they can walk out of the city manager's office 3 weeks before you actually put in the ordinance telling you that they agree with you and will support you. And when the cameras come on, they tell you something else.
The motion, as I understand it, is to send this back to committee.
Right.
And at this point, I'm wondering if after all this time, where is there going to be an opportunity for change by doing that? Because it doesn't make any sense to do it, in my opinion, if nothing's going to change. I haven't heard anybody say, well, you know what, if I knew this, I'd change my opinion. So, you know, I know everybody wants to talk about the substance, but we still have discussion to go on the substance. So
I'll stick to the motion.
Can we kind of figure out what we're going to do on this motion first? Councilman Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and I will stick to it, but I will require an example to do it, and then maybe later I will get to your question on food handling if we get back to the ordinance. Mr. Mayor, Councilman Sharp's question on the face of it sounds quite reasonable. The Salvation Army gets up, they speak against it. We should pay attention to that. The reality is that in 4 meetings in the city manager's office over the course of 3 months, with the Salvation Army, with taking it to the streets, with Uplift, we thought we reached a consensus 3 weeks before this went into first reading. And at that time, we said, based on what we believe is that consensus, which is embodied in the ordinance that you have before you, we'll move forward at this date. So I appreciate the sentiment. The reality is we tried to do that. This ordinance would never have come forward. And I said it many times. It would not come forward until we had what we believed was a consensus. Sometimes you don't agree on everything, but we asked for a consensus to move forward. We thought we had that.
And again, that was the voice of Councilman Wagner. And I'd like to point out here that while Councilman Wagner was talking about a consensus, including with groups like Taking It to the Streets, food sharers, including the director of said Taking It to the Streets, a longtime well-known organization that has been feeding the homeless for years, were shaking their heads no, in effect asking what consensus Wagner was talking about. I'll have a comment from one of those people in a couple of minutes.
So when each of those groups in turn got up to speak against it, what it told me was, it doesn't matter if this goes back to committee. It doesn't. Because these issues that we have raised and that have been raised over several months, for some folks, it just doesn't matter. So to the mayor's point, we have this motion, we can vote on it. I'm going to vote against it because until I hear something that is substantive that needs to be changed or needs to be addressed, simply sending it back so more people can rail against it. I've done that once. I did that yesterday. And it makes no sense. If no one wants to do it, fine. You have another recourse, which I've already suggested. So thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Councilman Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to be very clear, as I have mentioned many times to Councilman Wagner and to my colleagues here, is that my goal is certainly not to kill the ordinance as proposed. And it baffles me to sit here and hear comments such as everybody agreed to the ordinance as proposed, and then I look in the audience and I see all heads shake, SMH, as in no, that we didn't. Now,
SMH. What's SMH mean?
Shaking my head.
Oh, okay. That must be one of the things. Yeah, because it takes.
I probably shouldn't have said that.
Because it takes so long to say shaking my head.
Old school, young school, Mr. Mayor. SMH. Either way, I would think that although there was the SMH, I do think that we probably can get some agreement from this ordinance in hopes that the persons who are now opposed to it, that perhaps there were some miscommunication in terms of they agreed and didn't agree, or whatever the case may be. I think we can't come to a reasonable agreement so that we don't have the perception or public perception that we're just trying to ram something down the throats of, you know, citizens or organizations that are trying to do the right thing. And that we as a city can't work with them. And so I stand behind my motion in hopes that we can come up with some agreement.
Councilman Wagner, you'll be the last on this.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just to be clear, it's not just me who felt like we had an agreement. Councilman Markison was in many of those meetings with these same groups that I'm talking about here. City manager was in there. A city attorney was in there. Representatives of the health department were in there. Other members of the city manager's staff. And we all came to the conclusion together that we were at a point where this could come forward. So it wasn't just me hearing what I wanted to hear. It was our professional staff from a number of departments who were in the same room at the same time hearing the same things that I heard.
So Wagner weighed in about the consensus again, but this time only talks about city officials and staff, not the boots-on-the-ground organizations who would be directly affected by the ordinance if it passed. And therein, I believe, lies a major part of the problem here. Even giving the benefit of the doubt for very good intentions, there is an arrogance that was on display that dismissed the need for the input or opinion of affected groups. The councilmen and city staff already know what they think they need to know, so there's no need whatever to go back to committee and get input from any of those who were shut out of the process.
So I actually echo, though, Councilwoman Markison's suggestion. I don't know what more I can do. I really don't, because no one's told me what needs to change. No one. And so if someone else in this council can do what I cannot do, and we send this back to committee, go for it. Because, Mr. Mayor, I don't know what else to do. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. All right. There is no further discussion on the motion to send this matter back to committee. So will the clerk please call the roll?
Wagner?
Wait a minute.
Sorry.
Aye sends it back. No does not. Right? All right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Wagner?
No.
Davis?
Yes.
Ford?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Curls?
Aye.
Reed?
Aye.
Glover?
No.
Markeson?
No.
Serco?
No.
Brooks? Taylor?
Aye.
Sharp?
Aye.
James?
No. Motion fails. Back to the substance of the most of the ordinance. Any further discussion on the ordinance? Councilman Sharp.
I'd like to inquire of the sponsor. Let's talk about food handler cards.
Food handler cards are treated in the same way under all of our permits. Basically, you have two choices under current ordinance. You can go for an individual card, and typically organizations have to have 80% of their people with individual cards. Or alternatively, like under all of our other permits, you can have a food manager card. The basic difference in this context would be the food manager could be the lone person that gets the food handler card, and they would be responsible and provide supervision for all other volunteers that are there on site. There is no requirement that volunteers in this case have to have them, but either 80% of those on site who are volunteers would, or the food manager or supervisor in this case would have to have one. In either case, the individual ones are all free. The food manager one is usually $50, but should this ordinance pass, I'll present a subsequent ordinance to pay for the food manager card. But within the language, and I think that's where the confusion may be, we don't differentiate that a volunteer would have to have one, just that either volunteers or the manager would. So if you would, and this is consistent with our other language under other permits. However, if you wish to clarify that language to spell out what I've just said more clearly, I would take that as a friendly amendment.
One further question. The manager that would have to have that would be the manager for the licensed kitchen.
It would be, in this case, the manager who is on site at the point of delivery of the food item. So, which is the distinction you would have between the other different permits.
After a good bit of more discussion, the proposed ordinance itself finally came up for a vote.
The ordinance is now before council. The clerk will call the roll.
Wagner?
Aye.
Davis?
No.
Ford?
No.
Johnson?
Aye.
Curls?
No.
Reed?
No.
Glover?
Aye.
Markeson?
Aye.
Serco?
Aye.
Brooks? Taylor?
No.
Sharp?
No.
James?
Aye.
Six ayes, six nays.
The ordinance fails.
In the elevator lobby after the final vote, I caught up with one of those shaking his head at Councilman Wagner's claim of having reached consensus. What's your name and who are you with?
I'm with Jerry. My name is Jerry Whistler. I'm a leader of a ministry out of Sheffield Family Life Center called Feed the People. We've been going out for the last 21 and a half years every Saturday, no matter what the weather is, to just let people know they haven't been forgotten. We give them a good nourishing meal, and that's what we've been doing. I mean, all this time and stuff. So.
Now, I don't know if I recall exactly what groups he mentioned, but Councilman Wagner suggested that a lot of groups were included in, I think he mentioned, four or more meetings and came out with a consensus that this was a good thing, and then all of a sudden they changed their mind. What's your reaction to that?
Well, all groups were not included, especially the churches. I feel like a lot of the churches were excluded. And that was, I don't know if that was delivered or not. Like I mentioned yesterday when I talked to them, that could have been an accidental oversight. I don't know. That's between them. But we've never been asked. They know we're out there. They know what we've been doing, these church organizations. And a lot of them are not overlapping and stuff. It's not what they're saying. What they've been saying, that's not really true. And we all have like little areas we go to and stuff like that. So. And we go to also apartments, hotels, motels, rundown places. That's what we do. No matter what the weather, if it's raining Saturday, we're there. If it's blowing snow, we'll still be there because people just, they really appreciate what we do. And it's just, we're feeding between 425 to 500 people each Saturday. You know, it makes an impact. And kids and things like that, we're blessing them. And like the foodborne illness issue that is trying to raise, that's never happened. It's never happened.
Do you oppose everything about this ordinance, or do you think some of it could have reached the mythical consensus that he mentioned? If you had been included, are there parts of it that you would support?
Well, as the ordinance was written, it criminalizes honest citizens because they'd have to get this permit, food handlers permit. Also, it discourages volunteerism, and also kids who want to do community service, good or bad, it'll discourage that because they'd have to go through the process to get this permit. And also, like my van drivers, we operate two vans, they would have to get this food handlers, the manager's permit and stuff. And when we had our kitchen licensed about 12, 13 years ago, the city health department walked me through it. We did it. I carry a permit for Sheffield and stuff. They said keep it on file there. Now, I know it's changed since then, but still, we're going by the grandfather clause, I guess you could call it. So that's what we've been doing. But no, the way it was written up, no, it wasn't good at all. It wasn't good at all. And they didn't bother to get our input. And you got elderly folks who come and help out prepare meals. We got people who are north of here, I mean, from about a 3-hour drive away, they come down the last Saturday every month, the recovery group phone and stuff to help out. So they would have to get these permits and things like, or handler's license and stuff. So it was not very well thought out. And it kind of makes you wonder if there's somebody behind the scenes who's trying to push this.
Three or four food providers I had talked to in the last couple of weeks mentioned one Evie Craig, director of Restart, one of the four or so favored homeless shelters in Kansas City, as being a force behind the scenes pushing the ordinance. Craig was prominently featured in the Kansas City corporate media 18 months or so ago in stories discussing the possibility of an outright ban of feeding the homeless outside of established shelters. And she also appeared back then on this show in something of a debate on the subject with Care of Poor People director Richard Tripp.
She hates us. She's denied people, if they come over to get food or even have a prayer or communion when we have that there. We always have prayer, but if they want to take communion, she told them, if you go over there, we're going to kick you out of Restart. And you know they did close down the emergency shelter at Restart. It's no longer in existence. She closed it out. And that was the foundation of that there. I think Mr. Whitney, who started Restart years ago, that was the foundation of it. Now she's closed that out.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.